out there. It's a good morning to everyone out there. It's a rainy Sunday, but it's holiday week. Christmas is around the corner. Welcome to We the People, brought to you by Reading Tea Party. We're at KCNR 1460. If you want to give us a call, the number is 530-605-4567. To chat with us or for live streaming, go to KCNR1460.com. Good morning, Chandler. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning, Miss Elizabeth.
How are you guys?
We are swell, and I just wanted to let people know that you can find all the things for this program and information about our guests at teapartymedia.net. That's kind of a one-stop shop for all sorts of things there. And we'll be putting information up about our special guest today, Danielle Lindler, with statistics and all sorts of stuff on there. But I need her to resend those to me again because they're not in my email.
And if you do want to check out any previous shows that we've had, can go to readingteaparty.net or teapartyvideo.net or readingteapartyvideo.com.
Okay, wait.
Lots of options.
Okay, teapartymedia.net. Start there. And you can go to all
and
sorts of other places from there.
You can go to all kinds of things. So if you want to catch the previous show and get the info on that, that's the place to go.
Absolutely. We've got Christmas week coming up, and so our program for next Sunday will actually be pre-recorded. We have Dr. Tom Andrews and Pastor Richard James on there. So they're going to record on Tuesday. If you want a sneak preview of their program, come to the Reading Tea Party meeting tomorrow night. We're at 2570 South Bonneview at Bonneview Baptist Church. We meet at 6 o'clock every Monday night. So it'll be the Tom and Richard sneak preview of the radio program and dessert potluck.
Great chance to kind of network a little bit with other patriots, like-minded people, a casual atmosphere, very fun. So it's a great opportunity to get to know people in a really festive setting.
Yeah, and you can't blow it at a dessert potluck. I mean, you know. Bring something fun or something they make at Costco, like I'm probably going to do.
Cheesecake. Bring the cheesecake.
All you have to do is show up, and I'm sure there'll be too much. So if you forget, show up anyway. Bring a friend. It'll be fun. So we're talking about private property rights. That's kind of our theme right at the moment because so many things intersect in the land of private property rights. We were talking about a lot of things in Siskiyou County only because they are very much a lightning rod right now for a variety of things. They have issues with the dams up there. The environmentalists and other people want to take the dams out and rewild the river. Well, there are people who live on those reservoirs. The rivers provide, yeah. You know, that there are clean hydropower being created by those dams.
And it's interesting, the interesting thing about that is that in the land of clean energy, hydro is pretty clean and they want to shut it down. So, you know, give me the logic in that.
They think clean coal would be a better replacement. How'd you like to try to...
I wish they'd make up their mind.
Yeah, how'd you like to set up
paper bags, plastic bags, cloth bags. Which is it going to be this week?
Yeah, well, which are they going to fine us for? That's actually it. It's not what you're
going to
use.
There you go.
Yeah, what are we going to have to pay extra for?
Yeah.
Because we're bad. Bad humans. And so, anyway, you've got the issue with the dams up there. Then you've got the 600,000 acres they want to do for a monument. And I'm sorry, but in my world, a monument is a big rock with a man on a horse and a sword, I think. I mean, 600,000 acres. What the heck? Craziness. So there's that. You have the 1600 permits where people who use diverted water who've been doing that for well over, 100 years, now they're going to have to pay some massive permit fee. All these things just start tapping into people at a level that they can't, for one, fight back on because there's no real reason for it.
No logic there. Well, there is a reason.
Well,
these state agencies are not getting the funding out of the general budget that they used to get, so they've been given carte blanche to go ahead and create fines and fees and ways to fund their coffers and their jobs.
Well, I mean, and that's regardless of the sciences behind a lot of these things, a lot of them there's really not a lot of good. Historical data behind it. And Danielle's coming on this morning with us to talk about specifically issues with the forest and how we have how we've gone from, you know, cutting and doing things in sort of a, I guess, an unhealthy way. But that was a long time ago.
Right.
Forest.
And this is an issue near and dear to my heart.
Yeah.
Because we're in the forestry business ourselves, so I've been living the reality of it for a long time.
Absolutely. I watched Humboldt County close down in the 80s.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, so anyway, I think you guys will like it. We're going to jump off here, have a brief commercial, and then we'll be right back with Danielle Lindler. You are listening to KCNR 1460 AM, Shasta Running, the home of Free Fire Media.
Welcome back to We the People, brought to you by the Reading Tea Party at KCNR 1460. Don't forget to give us a call, but don't wait till the last minute. 605-4567 for live streaming or chat, kcnr1460.com. And I want to let you know that We the People today is brought to you by our three great Patriot sponsors. We have Miller Auto Transport, and Bill Miller pretty much transports anything with four wheels. If you've got a luxury vehicle that you need to haul overseas or across country, he does a lot of military vehicles, anything along those lines, anything that is on the road on four wheels, that's the guy to call. And you can reach him at 800-775-1321. And our next is North State Consultants. Mark Kent is a great tax guy. He actually finds ways to help you keep your money rather than finding ways to help you pay the government. To reach him, you call 221-0101. And last but certainly not least, our pals, Pearson Excavating. They are really talented folks. Dan and Roxy can pretty much do anything from pave a road to build a pad foundation for a home, dig a pool. They can be reached at 396-2464. And again, for any of that information, go to teapartymedia.net.
It's all there on the page. And how'd you like that subtle bumper music that Chandler whipped up for us?
Yeah.
It was getting kind of boring. We're using the same stuff over and over again.
Yeah, I saw those folks in concert last summer at Sean Hannity's show. They were awesome. Awesome. That was a great concert. That's their tribute to patriotism.
Well, you can't...
God and guns.
Can't go wrong with a little God and guns, I guess.
And a little God.
Yeah, a lot of God. Actually, and it's the right season for that, too.
Yeah.
So we talk about all the things that are politically incorrect, so why not move on to the forest?
Yeah. Sounds good.
Danielle, are you lurking in there?
Good morning,
Danielle. Hi.
Hey.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Hey, tell me this, a little bit of housekeeping here. Did you fire me off that email with all your info on it? Just out of curiosity.
It's on its way.
Oh, okay, great.
And I think what happened is I sent so much information at once, it got jammed, so I'm resending it.
No problem. I just wanted to stop scanning my junk folder, my deleted folder.
No, my apologies, but it's on its way.
No, I should have checked last night. So anyway, well... Okay, so I have here that you are a registered professional forester and a pest control advisor.
Yes.
So you have to tell us about that, and then let the folks know how many registered professional foresters there are, because that was interesting.
Okay. Well, a registered professional forester, the acronym being an RPF, is somebody that is licensed to practice forestry in the state of California. In the state of California, you have to be licensed to practice, and to get that license, it takes a minimum of 7 years to qualify for a state exam. Four of those years can be substituted with a Bachelor's of Science in Forestry from a Society of American Forester accredited university, such as like Humboldt State, Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo, or UC Berkeley in California. Then once you get your degree, which is typically no longer just 4 years, it typically takes about 5 years to get that degree because of all the requirements for units. Then you have to take an apprenticeship where you do 3 years of qualifying work experience under somebody that has their license. And then once you have that minimum of 7 years, then you take a state written exam that's offered twice a year, and you have to pass that written exam with a 75% or higher. It's not multiple guests and fill in the bubble. It's, you know, legal size, no margin paper, writing essays. The test.
That's everybody's favorite.
Everybody's favorite. I think my test was 56 pages of legal pad writings on anything from environmental law to designing culverts and roads to archaeology to fish habitat protection.
Yeah,
so
you have to know quite a bit.
It covers a broad range of issues, the test does. So, and then once you get that, once you pass, then you are a registered professional forester. The requirement for the license started in the 70s with the passing of the Forest Practice Act and the Professional Foresters Law. And since that time, there's only been about 3,200 licensed RPFs. And as I understand it, the first 1,000 were grandfathered in the 70s. But there's not many of us. And then as far as actually practicing licensed foresters, I don't think there's any more than 600 to 800 active licenses in the state.
And Danielle, do you know much about the current status of that profession and how many students are actually going for their RPF, their license? I mean, is it slacking off? Are they being discouraged from studying this profession?
I believe it's slacking off. I mean, it's been going in the 80s. You know, it was, you know, at Humboldt State, which is my alma mater, there were, you know, 100 students per grade. Now, like when I graduated in 97, there was 30 of us, and I've heard that it declined from there. I think there's actually been a little bit of resurgence and interest in forestry because Berkeley has improved their program and revamped their program. As well as Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, which didn't have a program when I was in college, has a pretty rigorous program, and they're getting a lot of non-traditional type students going there.
Now, I'm wondering how many of those go into private practice or how many actually go to work for the government?
I can't say.
Yeah, hard to say for the
that. You know, my own knowledge, because I'm a consulting forester myself. My husband and I own our own business. I do know this year we got a lot more resumes than we have in the last few years from college students. I know the Forest Service is hiring as well, so I don't know. But I don't know what the current trends are. I know when I was graduating in the 90s, most of my classmates were private industry.
Yeah.
Most were. So, but I don't know if that continues today.
Now, based on your experience since you got out of college, and so we're talking, just to kind of round up a little bit, 15 years.
Yeah.
What have you seen happen to the forestry industry in 15 years based on, as a direct result of state and federal regulations?
It's become more onerous. The first timber harvest plan I wrote, which a timber harvest plan is the document you need to harvest timber. The first one I wrote was 32 pages, and now the 32 pages doesn't even finish the beginning of a current THP where you have the introduction. That 32-page plan now is about 150. The average plan is probably that we write is probably 200 to 300 pages. So a lot more paperwork, a lot more restrictive where you can't harvest. And not that the laws have changed. I would argue it's a reinterpretation of the existing laws.
And tell me this, in other states, is it this rigorous?
No. California has the most most rigorous, most restrictive laws in the country, and some argue in the world.
And there are states where you don't even have to have a license.
Of the states that are timbered, you do not have to have a license. And those that do don't necessarily have the standards that California has or the responsibility placed on a RPF to practice forestry. When we write a timber harvest plan, that becomes law of the land for that property. And anything we write in that document has to be accurate and true. There's laws on the books currently that if something goes drastically wrong, RPS can be held criminally liable,
mm-hmm.
and we could face up to 2 years in jail and a $10,000 penalty.
Yikes.
So I guarantee you, with, you know, having a family of small children,
mm-hmm.
When I write THPs, I make sure every I's dotted and T's crossed, and
right.
that what we're doing on the land is sustainable.
Now, Danielle, again, taking that 15-year period roughly,
mm-hmm.
the cost to the landowner from beginning to end to complete the THP process so that they can begin to harvest their timber, what have you seen happen to the cost to the landowner from, you know, like 1997-98 to now?
Well, I actually have some statistics that were from 2008.
She was going to hit us with some statistics on how many acres. Tell people the stuff you told me. Let's start with that. The 101 million acres, because it really necks down, and then it gets to the cost.
Yeah. Okay, well, in California, we're approximately 101 million acres with what I know, the state as a whole. Of that, there's, depending on which book you go to, but there's about 32 million acres of that is considered timberland. Of that timberland, it's broken up into national forest land, state, county, and municipal land, and then you have private land, which is broken up into private timber companies and private small landowners, you know, like grandma and grandpa, you know, owning the back 40 type of landowner, mm-hmm. which we call non-industrial. Of that, let's see, on the private land, I found some numbers. There's about 4.2 million acres that are commercially held, managed for timber by a company. And then there's about another 4.6 million that is owned by small landowners. The Forest Service is the largest federal, largest landowner in the state for timber, and they have about 9.2 million acres in the state. And the remainder is just other landowners. In 1997, which is right about the time I got out of college, there was 1,008 timber harvest plans approved by the California Department of Forestry. They are the lead agency that is responsible for reviewing harvest plans. However, I'll get into it later, they're not the only agency that reviews what we do, but they are the ones that approve them. So there was 1,008 THPs approved in 1997, and then 10 years later, they only approved 371 timber harvest plans.
Wow.
In 1997, that 1,000-plus THPs accounted for 235,000 acres. In 07, that 371 approved THPs was 120,000 acres. However, when we look at the enforcement and the review of timber harvest plans...
Mm-hmm. I bet that's gone way down, too.
Yeah, that's gone way down. Being facetious. And I'm going to digress this real quick, but timber harvest plans, real quickly, are reviewed or submitted to the Department of Forestry. They're reviewed by Department of Forestry, Department of Fish and Game, Mines and Geology, Water Quality, sometimes the Coastal Commission, sometimes Fish and Wildlife Service, sometimes Caltrans. It just depends on what the issues are within the watershed that you're harvesting. Depends on who the players are in the review. This all falls under CEQA, a CEQA review.
And CEQA is?
The California Environmental Quality Act.
There you go.
Which sets up any time you have need a permit for your property, it has to be, it goes through the CEQA process, basically. So anyways, once those reviewing agencies get a take a look at your plan, they come up with a list of questions called first review. Then they have the opportunity to go on your property, called a pre-harvest inspection, and look at any point on the plan that they want to look at. It could be a road, it could be, you know, a culvert. It'll definitely be your creeks. It'll definitely be your logging systems. They want to know where you're going to land the logs. Anything they want to see, you have to show them. Once they look at your property, then they go back and do what they call second review and reevaluate your plan and shoot the RPF more questions. All the while, public comment is going on, and the public, including adjacent downstream landowners and typically a lot of environmental groups and concerned citizens, also get a comment and review your plan and submit comments to CDF.
And so that's even if this is you live on a lot of acreage and you want to take some timber off of that, now all your neighbors get to weigh in on how you do that.
Yeah, and I would clarify, not even a lot of acreage.
I've got
5-acre properties, mm-hmm. and they have to follow the same process.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll get into that real quick. But back to the quick statistic. For all of that review, in 1997, when things were simpler,
mm-hmm.
It was about $10 million was the program cost for all these agencies in the state, just the state agencies, not Fish and Wildlife Service, et cetera, to review timber harvest plans. It has since 2007-2008 fiscal year grown by 131%,
wow.
and now it's $23.1 million is budgeted for enforcement and review of timber harvest plans, all the while keeping in effect, you know, THP volume, acres is less than half, and quantity of timber harvest plans is about a third.
Wow.
But the costs are going up.
So your ability to get away with a lot of, bad forest practice in the state of California is pretty much zero?
Yeah. Yeah, that is to say it simply. The inspectors, or the forest practice inspectors through CDF, also have the right during your timber harvest operations, because you get a timber harvest plan and it's good for 3 years. And then, depending on the markets and the availability of loggers, which also, by the way, have to be licensed in the state, they have the right to come out and review your property. And they will look for any infractions that are not compliant with the existing rules or not compliant with the timber harvest plan as written.
Now, Danielle, the book, the Forest Practice Rules book that you do get from CDF that as a forester you follow, how closely would you say these agencies follow those rules, or is it completely based on their own interpretation?
I think it depends on the rule, but there is a lot of reinterpretation and an additional mitigation that happens sometimes, especially in the arena of water quality protection.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm getting at there is, you know, there'll be experts, quote-unquote experts, that will state that we need, instead of the proposed culvert that you have on your road, we want a bridge. Or we want something else that's going to cost the landowner, instead of a couple thousand, $10,000 to $20,000.
Mm-hmm.
That's the reinterpretation that happens quite often. As far as what is in the forest practice rules, of which there's about 1,100 different rules just in that one one law book,
mm-hmm.
They follow it pretty close. I mean, every I's dotted and every T's crossed when they approve a timber harvest plan. But that's not the only law that we follow as well. We have to follow the Federal Clean Water Act, the California version of that, the Porter-Clone Clean Water Act. We have to follow the Endangered Species Act, both at this federal level as well as the California Endangered Species Act. We have to follow the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act, and on and on.
It also involves, you have to protect a lot. I mean, there's a lot of botany involved as well.
Yes.
And,
yeah, when you want to go harvest trees, a typical scenario is you contact a registered professional forester. They'll come out and evaluate your property and give you initial consultation to see if it's feasible. Once they determine the project is feasible, they'll consult you on how to manage your trees depending on what your objectives are. And then depending on what area you are, if you're north of Highway 299, you're in what we call northern spotted owl territory, and you need to...
Wait, we should have a brief pause.
Northern, you have to hoot for spotted owls.
Mm-hmm.
You have to basically do what we call a natural diversity database search and evaluate the presence of not just within your property or on your property, but within the watershed and adjacent watersheds of threatened, listed, and endangered species, including spotted owl, goshawk, salamanders, plants, you name it. We have to evaluate the presence of those as well as the impact that the operations are going to have on those or would have on those. So yeah, we do manage for...
So, Danielle, when you meet with a client,
mm-hmm.
and let's say they've got 20 acres.
Okay.
And that's the small mom and pop, and that's anywhere from 20 to 40. And, you know, what they want to do is they want to thin their property enough to keep it fire safe, clean it up a little, you know, maybe put a little tiny bit of cash in their pocket. So when you go out and consult with them, taking into account everything that you know you're going to have to do, in addition to all the fees placed upon them by the regulatory agencies, how often is it literally not financially feasible for them to have any cleaning done of their property?
Well, right now on small landowners, it's extremely difficult, especially if they're within the, if they have salmonids on their property. I mean, God forbid they have water on their property,
mm-hmm.
That is like in the Klamath region, because there's 150-foot, basically no-cut buffers either side of the creek that they have to comply with, which takes a lot of land out of production. Or if they have listed species such as spotted owls, it is more often than not right now, especially with the down log market as well. Our industry is facing the lowest log market in recorded history,
mm-hmm.
you know, for the last 40, 50 years.
That's the part where people go to the lumber yard and they find that all the lumber they're going to build their house out of while they live in a place with a zillion trees is all coming from Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Indonesia,
Siberia,
yes.
New Zealand.
So stupid.
Yeah.
We have to take a little break here, but
okay.
So give folks something to think about. And when we come back, Danielle's going to tell us if big trees are older than small trees.
Okay.
So which are older, big trees or small trees? Okay, now you have a little break to hear some commercials. You're listening to KCNR 1460 AM, Shasta Redding, the home of Free Fire Media.
Welcome back to We the People, brought to you by Redding Tea Party. We're at KCNR 1460. Give us a call at 605-4567 or to chat or live streaming KCNR 1460. We're here with Danielle Lindler, a registered professional forester who's giving us the skinny on the timber industry. But right now, we've got a caller.
So, well, first we've got to answer
call about the trees.
Got to answer the big question. Danielle, talk to people about old trees versus young trees.
Okay. Well, actually, they could be the same age. The small tree could be older than the large tree. There's no correlation between the age of the tree and the size of the tree.
Ah, that's a big mystery solved.
Yeah.
People go into the woods and they see these big trees.
The size diameter, typically how we think of size, is depending on the density of the trees. So if there's a lot of trees being grown in one area,
mm-hmm.
you're going to end up with toothpicks for trees.
Uh-huh.
Because there's more competition for
sunlight,
nutrients in the soil, water, sunlight, et cetera. And also it's dependent on the genetics of the tree.
Mm-hmm.
You know, coast redwoods are going to grow larger diameters by their genetics than a knob cone pine just because of the genetics. So, but there's no correlation. I can grow a 30-inch tree on the coast in 50 years, or you can sometimes let Mother Nature do it, and it might take her 200-300 years.
Mm-hmm.
So It's all about competition.
So people get all worked up about big trees. About these big trees. Oh, they're cutting these ancient trees. And
yeah.
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily.
So so Mike is on here.
Okay.
I think.
Yeah, I've got a question for you.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. What's the percentage of trees that we cut versus grow, let's say in Northern California, or ratio?
Okay. Well, in Siskiyou County, which is what I'm most familiar with, the latest statistic I heard on federal land is that we grow 8 times more wood volume than we harvest in any given year in this county. And the trend I've heard for the state as a whole is we grow 4 to 5 times more volume than is harvested in any given year. So, and it's part of the law to be sustainable. We don't have the choice to not grow more than we cut. It's part of the law.
So then why are we getting trees from Canada and all those other places?
Because of the expense to harvest, it's actually cheaper to put wood on rail from Canada than to, for a lot of the mills to buy wood within 45 minutes to an hour drive of the mill.
And why is it so expensive, Danielle?
It's expensive because of all the different permits you need. The log prices are down. It's just the cost. In Canada, a lot of the third world countries we're getting wood from, they don't have the environmental conscience that we do in California. They don't have the environmental regulation that is spawned by this environmental conscience. Mm-hmm. And due to those factors, it makes the cost of review more expensive. For instance, a timber harvest plan typically costs anywhere from $10,000 to $35,000 just for the paperwork to be produced.
And that's on what size parcel?
I would probably say about 40 acres on up to, say, about 1,000 acres.
So 40 acres is grandma and grandpa or
yeah.
mom and pop.
Yeah, and that's only to get the plan written.
Yeah, yeah, that
and
doesn't include the harvesting
cost. And then you've got the 1,600 permit, which is administered by Fish and Game. And that's a stream bed alteration permit that you need. And there is a base plan for timber harvest plan for $1,345 plus $112 for each project. So say, and they consider, say you want to clean out your, fix your culverts or redo your culverts and you had 6 culverts, it'd be the base fee of $1,300 and change plus $112 times 6.
Wow.
Then Fish and Game also charges a THP review filing fee of about $950, which is going up in the next year to about $965. And then you have yield tax, which timberland
is
not valued. The timber is not usually valued in the assessment of property. The timber value is taxes collected on the timber value in what we call the yield tax, and that is 2.9% of the value of the delivered logs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's through the State Board of Equalization. And then you have to get a permit of waiver of waste discharge through water quality. And that's $1,200 minimum per year to enroll in that program. So as I stated earlier, a THP is open for 3 years. So that's a minimum of $3,600. But you are also able to get 2 one-year extensions for a total of 5 years. So you could be paying $1,200 times 5.
And Danielle, 10 years ago, what did it cost?
Not this.
Yeah.
Gosh, we were doing THPs for $5,000, $6,000 on, say, a 40-acre piece. So I would argue that it's doubled, if not tripled, because I haven't even gotten to the cost of all the surveys or archaeology, which archaeology has actually been pretty consistent in cost. Or the additionality of the protection of rules, which restricts where you can harvest even further. We've always had watercourse protection areas, depending on if your creek has fish or if your creek dries up. There's different buffer zones on either side of the creek that you have to follow. Well, now there's listed salmonid protection rules up off the Klamath if you have anadromous species. And if you have fish in a creek, it's 150 feet minimum either side. That is basically no harvest. And it...
So in a perfect world, if you wanted to harvest your timber, your property should be flat with no water.
Flat with no water and no animals.
Yeah. and where would that be?
You should be living on the moon.
Yeah.
Mike, are you still on there?
Yeah.
Just so people know, Mike's going to go up to Bernie, up there in Bernie at the Lions Club on Tuesday night at 6:30. Those guys meet up there. The Tea Party meets up there. And he's going to come down from Siskiyou County and do a program for them on this, similar to this, but more focused on the Siskiyou Crest National Monument that's proposed. And just we're really hoping that with you guys and all your expertise that we can get this information out to people so that people realize, although a lot of this is happening up in your area, it's coming for the rest of us.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The next line of defense is people like me who live on an acre and a half mm-hmm. with a well and a septic tank. It's mm-hmm. like, oh,
yeah.
No.
Yeah. And the whole point, and like Aaron said, the whole reason for the direction we're taking this show is to get this information out there, because people do have to realize that all of these different issues intersect and ultimately affect or destroy our personal right to own property. Okay. Our personal right to own property.
Yep.
And earn a living.
Yeah.
You know,
and there
absolutely
is that.
Earn a living. And one of the things that Danielle and I talked about yesterday was, I'm going to throw two things out here, because I'm looking at, we're in that part of the program where all of a sudden time goes really fast. We have like 15,
yeah.
we have 15 minutes left, and then all of a sudden it'll be over. One thing we talked about was how expensive clear cutting was, that it is absolutely just incredibly expensive. It is not a first alternative, and people are out there going, oh, we got to watch anybody with a sharp object. They're going to run out there and clear cut the forest, you know, which is a huge misnomer.
Yeah.
The next thing there is they're always talking about renewable energy, and we kind of clicked down a list yesterday. Biomass, you know, you can talk about that because that's your thing. Hydropower, windmills, solar, geothermal. The environmentalists don't want any of these, although they would be considered green alternatives, but each one of them is considered unacceptable.
Yeah, and in California we have AB 32, which was reinforced at the last election that the Californians want that law. And under that law...
No, it was reinforced that Californians don't understand what that law is
yeah,
going
exactly.
to do.
Yeah,
would,
they don't know. They don't understand what it's going to do, too. Sorry.
Yeah. I stand corrected. But AB 32 requires that by 2012, that we have 20% of our energy in the state coming from renewable resources. And the types of renewables you have is you have biomass, which is the burning of wood waste and yard waste. The environmentalists Siskiyou County, have been suing for the last 2-3 years, Roseburg Resource Company,
mm-hmm.
over an existing biomass facility that they have at their mill. Real quick, they have a facility that's been running the mill for years. And when it was built, they overbuilt it with the anticipation of, at some point down the road, that they will, instead of running it at 30% capacity to run the mill, they'll bump it up to 80% capacity and then sell off the energy as an alternative revenue stream. The city of Reading has bought the contract on that, and the renewable energy would burn for 9,000 homes, or provide for 9,000 homes. The environmentalists are stopping it. And then you have the dams. They're trying to take out, you know, 4 California dams on the Klamath. There was a lot of squawking over the windmills over Hatchet Mountain.
But wait, go back to the dams, because the dams provide power for, what, 73,000 people?
Yeah, it's a lot.
It's a lot. So they take those out, so you get 73,000 people that don't have any power.
Mm-hmm. And then another form of renewable energy that's been trying to be explored for the last decade is geothermal. Geothermal has been stopped for 10 years that I've been in, or longer than that, actually. Ever since I've been in Siskiyou County, which has only been about 13 years, it's been stopped.
Now, tell people what geothermal is and what the problem just kind of nutshell.
Okay, well, geothermal is where they tap into the heat resources, you know, like 5 miles down below the earth, and I'm being very simplistic here, and then capture the steam that's produced to turn a turbine.
Cool.
Mm-hmm. And then that produces energy. And then the other renewable is solar. And that's the only renewable resources that I was ever taught about in school.
Now, I cut you off on the windmills, not on purpose, but I stopped you on that. Go back to that. We have those windmills up on Hatchet. That was on Hatchet Mountain. That was a big deal up there. So do you know how many windmills are up there?
I actually don't know. There's quite a few. I honestly don't. And I know there was concerns about aesthetics, and I can appreciate that. But the reality is, if we're going to do renewable energy, it has to be in somebody's backyard.
The problem is those windmills haven't run for well over a month.
Yeah.
Because they don't have enough power. They have to get power to the windmills. The windmills don't turn themselves. They need power to get going, and they screwed up on the power.
What a quandary.
Oh, that's frustrating.
Yeah, so they screwed up on the power going to the windmills, so the windmills are just standing up there, giant white windmills, waiting to turn.
But currently, you know, like I said, our state's only at 5% renewables, and somehow we're supposed to get to 20%. Within 2 years, it's not going to happen.
How do we do that?
Honestly,
if they turn down
all
opinion, the...
We're going backwards.
Yeah, and Danielle, real quick, no, I don't want to get off track here, but just clarification for our listeners, what are the requirements for replanting after a clear cut?
After a clear cut? Well, if you clear cut in California, you have to plant a minimum of 300 trees per acre, and you can't go to Southern California and get ponderosa pine and decide to plant it up here in Siskiyou County. You have to get seed that is within, the state's broken up into seed zones, and you have to get seed within your seed zone and plant back in to make sure that
it's indigenous.
The tree is best suited for that site.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's not like they go in, they wipe out all the trees, and then they leave the land bare.
No. If that was to happen, which, you know, there would be a lot of fines given out, but mm-hmm. say somebody didn't really care and they paid the fines, the state has the ability to go in, do the work for you, and place a lien on your property.
Mm, okay.
So it will not happen in the state anymore. And one other quick criticism that I always hear about clear cutting is that, oh, they planted all back to ponderosa pine. They don't, you know, it's all a monoculture. Well, there's a reason for that. Ponderosa pine like bare mineral soil. They like full sun. You can't take a shade-tolerant species, such as like a fir, and plant it at 3,000 feet elevation in bare open sunlight and expect that tree to
survive.
To survive as well as you would a pine tree.
Mm-hmm.
Pine trees have evolved in this state with fire, and fire typically creates basically large clear cuts.
It can happen one of two ways.
Largest size clear cut you can do in this state is 20 acres if you're going to log it with a helicopter,
mm-hmm.
30 acres if it's really flat ground, and the maximum is 40 acres, although I haven't seen a 40-acre clear cut in many years.
Yeah.
So typically they're like 20-acre openings.
So really, in a nutshell, for all those that think that proper forest management shouldn't happen, I guess you could leave it alone and let nature take its course, at which point you have giant forest fires, all the animals die, and lots of smoke goes into the environment.
Yes. Yeah.
Simplistic
typically
terms.
Historically, our state evolved with fire. There was a fire on any given acre every 5 to 30 years. So with that being the case, if you're going to be a species living in California, you better like a lot of sunshine because you're going to get it. But during the 50s, after World War II, there was a large push to start suppressing wildfire. And it was to save, you know, people's homes and livelihoods. But that has created an overabundance of trees and fuel that's, I would argue, is in an unhealthy state at this time.
Mm-hmm.
Historically, there was 40 to 80 trees an acre. A lot of our forests, especially on federal land, have 300-400 trees per acre, and some areas even have as many as 2,000 trees per acre.
Jeez.
That is unhealthy, and it leads to large, hot fires.
They have 2,000 toothpicks per acre.
Yes.
At that point.
Yes.
That's a lot of trees on an acre.
Do tell people, we were talking yesterday, and you gave me an analogy of tomato plants, and I thought that was a really good visual, because a lot of people grow tomato plants. They might not have not have enough trees to cut or be involved in any of this, but almost everybody grows tomato plants.
Yeah. Well, my analogy was talking about, like, some people will say, well, can't you just thin the forest instead of clear cutting it? One of the reasons we might clear cut is if the trees aren't growing properly. And we can tell that by the growth rings. If they're really tight, we can tell that tree's suppressed. It's not doing very well. And so we might want to start that standover. And a lot of people say, well, just thin them out. And sometimes that will work. It's what we call release. However, if you grow tomato plants and you plant 20, 30 plants within a 4x4 square area, and then you decide in the fall, you know, I better thin out those plants. There's too many plants, and I'm not going to get a good crop. You've waited till the fall. It's already past the prime of that plant's ability to capture the additional nutrients in the soil. Whereas if you were to thin them out after, early mid-spring, early summer, they would have been able to take advantage of the site. And the same thing holds true with trees. You can't go out and thin a bunch of trees at 80 to 100 years old on a tree species that lives to 200 years old and expect it to start growing again and take advantage of that site. Sometimes you need to start over, plant healthy, young-growing trees, and get a more productive forest.
Mm-hmm. That's a great analogy.
That was the analogy.
That was good. And another good analogy is, you know, we all thin our gardens.
Yes.
As they're growing. There are some things that you plant, and that's it, you know, but for the most part, when we seed, we have to thin along the way for a healthy garden.
Exactly. And forestry is the same principle in forestry.
Mm-hmm.
If you have too many trees per acre, there's going to be an overcompetition for nutrients, sunlight, and growing space. You're going to end up with toothpicks for trees, as well as you're stressing out the tree. If a tree is under stress for nutrients and water, it can't fight off insects and disease, as well as a healthy tree that is not stressed for nutrients and water. And it has to do primarily with, like, sap production. And it's kind of like people. When people are stressed out, they're more likely to get sick.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same thing with trees. So you do need to have proper spacing. The other thing about clear cuts is a lot of people think a blanket of trees from, you know, the Pacific Ocean to the Nevada border, from the Oregon border to Mexico, is a healthy thing. That they want just basically a blanket of trees across the entire state.
Mm-hmm.
And that's only one habitat type. And they fail to recognize that our wildlife, as well as our native plant species, have evolved with disturbance through fire, primarily. And they need openings. And I would argue, as well as a lot of my wildlife biologist friends, that openings in our forest is one of the most lacking habitat types that we have.
Yeah.
I mean, you hear everybody say, oh, we're losing the old growth. Well, no, we're actually losing what we call early sere. Clear cuts definitely provide early sere habitat.
There is, there's going to be a huge, huge issue when we talk about the monument next. We need to have you come back, and I thought if we did this in order, you know, you can't fit everything in an hour, but if we did this in order, we could talk about good forest practice, and we could talk about how that's going to be impacted by things like the monument coming, you know, what that's going to do to our mining people, what that's going to do to people who just own land. So we're, of course, time sped up. So we have like a minute and a half. We'd like to really thank you for coming on with us this morning.
I hope to meet you someday, Danielle.
Great, me too. I hope to meet you as well.
Yeah. If you hang out at meetings, yeah. where people are getting regulated to death, Danielle's there. That's where we see each other all the time.
Yeah.
So thank you very much, and we're going to have you come back and talk about a little more of this as it relates to some specific projects.
Will do.
But
we really do appreciate your knowledge and your willingness to share that, Danielle.
Well, you're welcome. And if you guys have any more questions, I can answer them. Just get in touch with me via email.
Yeah,
or
and we'll have your information on our Tea Party.
When you send that to me, we're going to put that on teapartymedia.net so folks can go on here in another hour or so, pull the archive program and be able to listen to it again, see all the facts there. And just wanted to let folks know that next week will be a special Christmas program. It'll be pretty cool.
It will be fun.
And then we're going to get back into some more private property or lack thereof.
Yeah.
I'd like to invite you to the Reading Tea Party any Monday, 6 o'clock, Bonneview Baptist. You can check us online there. Follow the Tea Party Media site, and we'll talk to you later. KCNR, 1460 AM.
Happy holidays.